Hello, and welcome to the Hey Boomer Show, which is live every Monday on Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube, and then available as a podcast by the very next day. My name is Wendy Green, and I am your host for Hey Boomer. And Hey Boomer is for those of us who believe we are never too old to set another goal or dream a new dream. I am on a mission to support and inspire older adults in the second half of our lives. Together, we are learning and sharing stories. We are finding new beginnings and confronting endings and transitions. We are evolving rather than retiring. We are defining what this next stage of our lives will be like. My guest today is Rhonda Cook, and Rhonda was an investigative reporter who uncovered sexual abuse in a woman's prison. Her reporting had some significant ramifications, and it threatened her safety and security. Getting ready for this show, I had to think back on my involvement in activism experiences. I remember in the 70s, shortly after Roe v. Wade had passed, we held a candlelight vigil in Asheville, North Carolina. But we held it as an invitation-only event because we didn't want a lot of disruptive, angry people showing up at the candlelight vigil. I've also been part of thousands of people in marches in Washington, D.C. for women's rights. And it was so empowering to feel like you were part of a large group that all were here having our voices heard and being seen for the strength that we shared together as a community. And lately I've been involved in some demonstrations here in Greenville, South Carolina, certainly much smaller than DC, but because of some of the climate that we live in today, I always have this thought in the back of my mind of wonder if someone might show up trying to harm us at one of these events. So it's nice to be part of a group rather than an individual, but Rhonda faced a lot of safety and security issues as an individual. And safety and security is something that is important to me, and I'm not sure I could have done the kinds of work that Rhonda did. But before we bring her on and hear her story, I do want to ask for your help. Hey Boomer is, as I said, for a large community of people that are defining what the second act of their life can look like. And I need your help trying to reach them because I know that by hearing the stories that we talk about on the show, they can feel more empowered in their own lives. So I ask you to talk about the show, to suggest that your friends subscribe. You can forward our email to them because the subscribe link is at the very top of the email, or you can just simply copy this subscribe link, bit.ly/heyboomer-subscribe, and send that to them and say, you guys, you really want to be part of this community. So I really encourage you to help your friends find us and help grow the Hey Boomer audience. The other thing, we only have 4 more days for the Costa Rica trip to be open to just Hey Boomer friends and family. After that, I have to open it up to a larger audience. Being that there are only 18 slots available, I know that when we open it up, it's going to fill up. So if you think you might be interested in going to Costa Rica with us, send me an email at wendy@heyboomer.biz. So here's the deal. You put down a deposit. It's like $100 or $200, depending on if you're going by yourself or with somebody. If you cancel within 120 days of the trip, the penalty is only $50. So in a lot of ways, if you think you might want to go, it makes sense to reserve your spot now. You can always change your mind later. But if you don't reserve your spot by the 14th, there may not be a spot for you. So drop me an email at wendy@heyboomer.biz. I would love to have you on that trip. Rhonda's going, right, Rhonda?
Yes, I am. I've already signed up.
Yay, I'm so glad you're going. In fact, I met Rhonda on a Rhodes Scholar trip.
We did. We met like the first day, I think it was. I know. I mean, it was a big group and everyone met the first day, but
we connected.
Yes.
We connected. So let me tell people a little bit about you.
Okay.
Rhonda Cook was born in Middle Georgia and lived there most of her life. She graduated from the University of Georgia with a degree in public relations. She had not planned on becoming a reporter, but a year after she graduated, she was working for the United Press International. Her 40-year career as a reporter included two stints with UPI, time at the Austin American Statesman in Texas, and at a New York Times regional paper in Atlanta. The last 29 years of her career, she worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Rhonda's assignments included voting rights and election law, politics, including the Democratic and the Republican conventions in 1988, the Georgia legislature, political corruption, criminal justice issues, death penalty, and prisons. Rhonda left her career in 2018, but she has not retired in the traditional sense of retirement. She now volunteers as a patient escort with Planned Parenthood at one of the first abortion clinics in Atlanta. She has been a special advocate for a child in foster care before the juvenile court. She has worked as a poll watcher and ballot monitor and will do so again this year. She monitors the state election board and two local election boards for the ACLU. Rhonda has a dog named Luke, who missed her greatly when she was in Glacier National Park, which, as I said, that's where we met. So welcome.
I'm thrilled to be here. I've got my boy, Luke, distracted with a bone, so he should be a good boy. This is his time to sleep, so I'll keep my fingers crossed.
I know. No barking, Luke. Not allowed. Yeah.
He even does that first thing in the morning and at the end of the day. So we should be good for a while.
Oh, good. All right. So let's talk about this reporting. You fell into it. You know, like I always had this dream of being a reporter. I wrote briefly for a little local paper, but you fell into it. How did that happen?
Well, even my major, I picked at random. It was at the time when, you remember, we had our catalogs. They were catalogs. They weren't online. And I had to decide. I'd been through like seven different options of what I'd study. And I literally put my finger down in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications. And the major was public relations. So that's what I did. I was at Georgia Tech, where this was pretty cool. At that time, the male-female ratio was 1-9. So I was this little 22, 23-year-old. And it was 1-9. It was great. But I was bored. And my neighbor told her uncle about me, who at the time had just left being the White House bureau chief for UPI.
Oh, and gosh.
He said she'd be perfect for wire service. Now, I'd never been a reporter. I'd written a couple of stories for the local, for the college newspaper, the Red and Black. But anyway, I called the person he told me to call. Tell me if I'm telling you too much. Asked him to coffee. And instead of saying, okay, he put me on hold and transferred me to the state editor. Who talked to me for a minute and then invited me in for an interview. And I did the interview. I did a test to show I could report and then write a story. And they hired me 2 weeks later. That's how I became a reporter. And it was really a cool place to be. It was at that time, it was a 24-hour operation. We covered the state of Georgia. And then that's how it all started. It was meant to be. I was meant to be a reporter.
I guess you were. But yeah. My impression of back in the day, women reporters were very few and far between.
Yeah.
And those that were writing for papers were typically writing like leisure columns, advice columns, you know, those kinds of things. How did you get some of these amazingly juicy assignments?
Well, at UPI, we did not do those things, but I'll tell you an example. I worked a lot of weekends and a lot of weekend nights in the beginning, and there was a prison disturbance in Alabama, and Georgia covered Alabama at the time. And I was listening to them, and I was there. And I was listening to them go through the list of reporters they could send. And they said, no, I couldn't go. I was too green. And every reporter they named was a guy. And so finally I piped in and another reporter there who had been there 8 years. I said, what about Nancy Albritton? And they said, well, she's got all those kids. I said, she won't bring them with her. And that was when it clicked, like, oh my God. But they ended up sending one of the guys. But that's when it became clear. But it just so happened that we were a small operation. We only covered breaking news. And from there, I went from there. And I, while I was assigned stories over the years, when I went to Austin, I was there to write soft features for the section that had only recently been renamed. And then before it was renamed, it was considered the women's section.
Of course, right?
And all my years, I came up with my own stories. If something wasn't happening, I came up with my own stories. And even though I disparagingly called it the uterus beat, I would still come up with my own stories, which would be hard news. So I just kind of shoved my way into it. That's what I did.
And so you had to pitch those stories and get them to agree to publish them.
Well, they were going to publish. If they let me cover them, they were going to publish them.
Okay.
Because it would be a wasted resource. And when I would suggest the stories, I already had the story. So so they took it because they would be good stories. And then by the time I left Austin, then we had become more mainstream. But that was in the 80s. That was as recently as the early 80s.
Oh, I think it was even later than that before they really started to take women reporters seriously, as serious news reporters. Mm-hmm. So you then went to Atlanta?
I came back to Atlanta and back to UPI. And that was a rather short stint simply because I'd been there only 4 months when UPI was sold. And it was starting to disappear from the news landscape just because of the organization and stuff like that. But in that short time, I covered the politics. I covered the Marlitos, who got on boats and came to the United States, were sent to two prisons, one in Louisiana, one in Atlanta. And they were shutting down the Atlanta federal pen at that time. So they had to put them somewhere. And they put the Marlitos at the Atlanta federal pen. And technically, they were not in the United States. And around Thanksgiving, there was a riot at the facility in Louisiana because they heard that the United States was going to send them back to Cuba. And that one started. And then within a day or two, it spread to Atlanta. So I covered that with others because we were there 24 hours a day. And then right after Christmas, they started cutting and I was last hired. So I was the first let go, but I had a job the next day at the Gwinnett Daily News. And it was in the New York Times regional newspaper. They called me and they were trying to take on the New York Times was trying to take on the Atlanta Journal Constitution. So I just went from there to the Gwinnett paper and covered the state government, politics, and prisons.
So that's always kind of been your beat. You went from there then to Atlanta Journal Constitution and you were covering government, politics, prisons. Well,
and it started with my first stint at UPI because I worked weekends. There was a prison in South Georgia that was on federal court order and they had what they called checkerboard segregation of inmates, black and white, because that was one of the problems was racial. But what they would do is on Saturday night.
What does that mean, checkerboard?
They would have all the black inmates in one dorm, they would segregate the inmates by race. Black inmates only in one section, white inmates only in another, because that was the conflict there. And they were trying to get control of prison conditions and then inmate behavior. They didn't have enough staff. They didn't have the right kind of staff. Well, on Saturday nights, they bring all the inmates together to watch a movie, Black and White Inmates. So Saturday nights, I would be working and there would be a prison riot. That's how I got started covering prisons, was the inmates would riot at the Georgia State Prison at Reidsville.
So did you go to the riots?
No, we had that. We cover them. We had to cover them remotely.
Yeah, for your safety.
But I covered the reform until I went to Texas. And then when I came back, they were still doing it. But by that time, I had somehow gotten, and I don't even remember how I'd gotten in contact with inmates. And then they had a disturbance at another prison and they called me. And I remember there was banging in the background. And they were supposed to have been these secure places for officers to escape when there was a prison disturbance. And the inmates were telling me that they were break. And I asked them if that was those secure areas. They were dismantling. The inmates were destroying them. Again, but see, I had the inmates on the phone. Going down there wouldn't have done me any good. Because I couldn't go in the prisons. They were calling me and telling me what was going on.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's how I got into prison reporting. Again, an accident, just like I got into reporting by accident.
Wow. So we talked about this sexual abuse case when we were on our trip, and there's a lot to it. So can you kind of lead us through how it first came about?
Yeah. Well, again, it involved me answering the phone. And it was a woman who advocated for an inmate in prison. And this inmate, Holly Weiss, she was in prison for murdering her ex-husband. And Holly had breast cancer, and she didn't feel like the prison system was giving her proper medical care. So I got her records. I went down there to visit her, and I looked at her records. And when you're interviewing inmates, there's an extra obstacle because of credibility. I mean, they're in prison. And in prison for more serious crimes than lying. And I met with Holly and I looked at her and I just said, Holly, Holly was refusing treatment. So that created a problem. So, and Holly did eventually die, but she was out of breast cancer. But anyway, I told Holly, I said, I don't think I can do anything with it because you refused treatment. And she said, well, okay, that's fine. But I need to tell you about another thing going on here. And she gave me the name of another inmate tattoo. She told me about an inmate who had been in prison for 10 years who had recently had an abortion. Well, do the math. So I met with that inmate. Her name was Diana Kennedy. And Diana also told me to talk to another inmate who was not necessarily a victim of sexual abuse, but she had the in with all the inmates, Carmen Lopez. So I went back with Diana's records and wrote a story about how this inmate had the state had paid for her abortion, which the state did, even though she had been in prison for a long time. And the father was a maintenance worker at the prison.
And so there was no possibility that this came from a conjugal visit?
We don't have conjugal visits in Georgia.
Oh, okay. All right.
So don't have them. So then what happened was there was an attorney who had a dormant federal lawsuit about prison conditions. And he went down and interviewed this inmate who came to be known as Jane Doe 1 and interviewed a few other inmates. And he filed affidavits, revived the lawsuit and filed affidavits from inmates attesting to sexual encounters with officers, with staff. And it was... And in the meantime, Carmen Lopez, who was wonderful, kept putting inmates in touch with me.
Hmm.
And the inmates would call me and we would talk. And it wasn't just male staff having sexual contact with inmates, female staff also having contact with inmates. And they would either be coerced or they would promise them special treatment. They would promise them things like chewing gum, which was important, or the inmates actually thought they were in a real relationship. And it just spiraled out of control. I mean, it wasn't just inmates and officers that officers were taking inmates off property and prostituting them, photographing them. It was horrible. And that's how it got started. Is I went to talk to an inmate about her medical care, and she said, "Well, if you can't do something for me, how about this?"
So, but Rhonda, these women calling you, they had to be very trusting. I would think there'd be a fear of retribution, of getting found out that they're talking to you.
Well, yes, but they would call me Colette, and they would put me on their phone list. But there were so many of them. How did they narrow it down? Mm. Well, at first the state, and they were afraid. I mean, that's why they were identified in public records as Jane Doe and a number. Mm-hmm. And eventually what the paper did was to make it easier is they put in a special phone line for me that only went to inmates. Well, after all the initial turmoil and after all the changes at the top, the commissioner who came in to replace the one who was commissioner when this was happening, he put my phone number on every state inmate's phone list without taking one of their slots, male and female. And so they could call me. But they did. And by that time they knew who I was. And you know, Carmen and Holly also paved the way for me with these inmates.
Yeah, they did. But then, so there was some significant repercussions as a result of this reporting. How long did the story go on?
The story went on, it went on for over a year. Before what happened was initially then first some officers were fired, suspended, or they resigned. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation got involved. Eventually, there were a total of 15 men and women, staff workers, who were charged with felonies. And in Georgia, it's called sexual assault against persons in custody. But it doesn't just apply to inmates. It could apply to a teacher and a student, a doctor and a patient, where a person who has power over another can be charged with this felony and it carried a 3-year prison sentence. And one person was charged with this crime after 14 others had been indicted. I don't know, this guy was dumb as box rocks, I guess, had been going on. And he is a new hire and had a sexual encounter with an inmate. Those officers were charged with crimes as serious as rape and aggravated sodomy. All of them were charged with at least one or two counts of sexual assault against persons in custody. A total of 36 staff at three prisons, it expanded to two other prisons, were either fired, suspended, or they resigned because either they encountered inmates or they knew about it. For example, a warden at one of the prisons was accessing the records of inmates who had made accusations against a female employee and was feeding her information for her criminal case. Hmm. Unfortunately, what happened was, well, two officers pleaded guilty and they were sentenced to probation. This was only one county indicted inmates. The other two did not. Hmm. Charges against, I believe, three were dropped because the statute of limitations had expired, meaning too much time had passed. One officer, a lieutenant, and he was one of the most prolific ones, he went to trial on, I believe it was something like 22 felony counts.
Wow.
And a hometown jury acquitted him within 20 minutes. A third of the time it took the judge to explain the law and the charges to them, they acquitted him. And all the other cases just disappeared. They didn't do anything with them. But what did happen was they took the inmates at this prison, and this was one of like 8 prisons in one county. This county had 8 prisons, and yes, and the state mental health hospital. I did a story about how half of the people who live in this county or were in this county were either in prison or worked at a prison.
Oh, wow.
So it was their culture. Yeah. But what they did is eventually the entire prison administration was replaced at the women's prison. the Department of Corrections top administration was replaced, meaning the commissioner, deputy commissioners, they were all replaced. And then they took all the women at this one prison and moved them out of the county to a prison in Metro Atlanta to get them out of that culture, and then move the men who were at that prison to other facilities without. And the women's prison, it was eventually converted into another type of facility, but it wasn't a prison. So that was what good came of it. But it cost the state over $1 million in legal fees that they had to pay for lawyers to represent the inmates, for lawyers to represent the state, for lawyers to represent even some of the inmates. But nobody went to prison. That's what's sad. Nobody went to prison
for it. Yeah, I know you're disappointed about that, but you did raise awareness. You did make some changes and help a bunch of women. So that was good. But it also was pretty frightening for your life for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, what had happened is the maintenance worker who had impregnated the first Jane Doe, shortly after he was interviewed for the first time with the GBI, he was found in his pickup truck dead of rat poisoning.
Oh, my.
They never determined if it was suicide or something nefarious. All they said was it wasn't an accident. And his name was Bubba Holland. Well, not too long after that, the Department of Corrections received a message for me. I had two death threats that were delivered to the Department of Corrections and the state attorney general. And one of the messages was that I was going to die like Bubba Holland did.
Wow.
And they took it very seriously. And that was in 1992 in the fall. The story started in March of 92. And the paper took it very seriously. They put some security on me. But what coincidentally happened was right after that, totally unrelated, I was attacked at my apartment. And of course, a couple of people said, do you think it had anything to do with the women's prison? And that put it in my head. So for a while, I was pretty scared.
Yeah, I would think so.
I wouldn't go out. I was afraid to go outside, but that was very short-lived. It was very short-lived. I mean, for a very brief time, I told my dad, I said, can you get me a gun? And that upset my mother, that I felt like I needed one because she knew I was terrified of guns. So my dad took me out to my grandmother's farm and gave me a little revolver and 7 bullets. And I asked him if I needed more, and he said, you shouldn't need more than 7 bullets. I had a gun for about 6 weeks, and then I returned the gun and the 7 bullets to my dad, and I was okay. But it took about 6 weeks for me to get past that initial thing. And after that, I wasn't afraid of anything. I was not afraid of anything.
Yeah. I know you've said that to me before, and I don't know how you can not be afraid of anything. You know, it's just there's so much out there that can be harmful. So you are practicing it that now though, Rhonda. You have retired.
I am.
So to speak, retired. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now you're doing some other things that are requiring a certain amount of courage.
Right. Well, when I was a reporter, we could not do anything. We couldn't do anything.
You could not be an activist, you mean?
No, yeah. No, yeah. Not for a little while. They let me volunteer with a rape crisis line. But, you know, how do you find somebody what's the other side of a rape? You know, how do you argue that I would be biased? But I had to get permission. And I did that for a short while. But I was hypervigilant about anything that might suggest I had a bias. Mm-hmm. And so that was never a problem with the paper. But once I retired, it took some adjusting for me to know that I could have opinions. I could just do whatever I wanted.
Yeah, there's a sense of freedom to that, isn't there? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I can't imagine how hard that had to be, though, to not have a bias when you're writing a story.
No, I was pretty good at sitting on the fence. Huh. And I learned from this because I learned that everybody had a story. Everybody had a truth that was their truth. And I just respected it. I mean, the first execution that I witnessed, the man had killed three people. And I got to know him very well, because at the time the prison gave us access to this to inmates, even those on death row. And I liked him. And I told people he didn't do anything to me. I didn't know the people he had harmed. He had acknowledged that he had done bad things and he wanted to take his punishment. And so I got to where I could just sit on that fence and see both sides and know that, you know, everybody had their own truths, and I just recognized it as such.
So now that you now have your opinions and you're actively involved in things, can you still see both sides?
Yeah, in certain areas I can. When I'm doing the escorts at the clinics, my opinion is, okay, you can be opposed to abortion, but other people have different lives, different reasons for being, and it's none of your business. I can acknowledge their position, but their position is not mine. And I believe that it's an individual's decision, not someone else's decision on whether or not they do that. So I don't know if I'm seeing both sides or not. When I do the voter protection hotline, I had a woman call one time and I had to ask her name and number. She said, "Do you want to know if I'm a Republican or a Democrat?" I said, "Nope, I don't care. I just want you to vote." Right. And I have faith that if people make informed decisions when they vote, it'll all be okay. The problem is people who don't have informed decisions, but.
Yeah. So when you're escorting people at Planned Parenthood, you said they call you names and you feel threatened there?
Well, no, at Planned Parenthood in Atlanta, the demonstrators have not been there a lot recently, but at the clinic where I volunteer, there's at least one that's always there, Jason. And he calls me a death squad. He calls me killer granny. And there was one occasion where I walked off the property with a patient. She wanted to go down the street to meet a taxi. Well, once we walked off the property, Jason could approach us. And he kept bumping me. He kept bumping into me. And I turned around and I said, "Back off." And my opinion was, first of all, I was bigger than him. I was taller than him. I was surprised at how small he was. And secondly, you just have to confront the bullies, you know, and he did. I said, "Stop touching me." And he did. I mean, he still followed us down the street, but I stood up to him and, you know, made myself big and tall. And
yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I've had experiences where I've had to do things like that. I remember one time in Atlanta, I was on the MARTA and there were two teenage girls and this guy in a hoodie, and he looked all kind of creepy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he starts harassing them. And I finally said, "You need to stop. They don't want to talk to you." And he starts glaring at me. And then, you know, the MARTA doors open and we all got off, and he got off too. And I'm saying to the girls, "Come on, let's go. Let's up the stairs. Let's go." Yeah. So, I mean, I confronted him, but I was scared after we got off.
You didn't show him, because that's what he wanted. He wanted you to be scared. And I learned from my inmates that I talked to that if I was respectful of them and I didn't act afraid of them, and of course, how would they hurt me? I mean, I was in the prison, but I was respectful, but I wasn't afraid of them either. Mm-hmm. And that's how some people get away with it. They make you afraid. So you make the decision whether or not you're going to be afraid. After my thug, I call it my thug attack. When I saw the gun, all of a sudden this calm came over me. And I just said, "What do you want?" And before he could answer the question, a rescuer yelled at him and he ran away. But see, he was confronted and the guy backed down. You know, some people may not back down, but
that's right.
But you just have to, they're going to do what they're going to do, but you just have to, if you show respect and that you're not afraid, you know, it might be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, right. I think the more you show fear, the more they can take advantage. So, yeah. All right. So you left and you're redefining yourself now in multiple ways. What gives you the most satisfaction in your life and what you're working on now?
The voter protection, because I believe that that's where that's most important. Like even the abortion thing, you gotta vote. If you don't vote and get the people in, then that's not gonna be protected. And you see, it's not been protected by the way the vote has gone. So that's what gives me the most satisfaction. Early voting starts here in a week, and I'll do some poll observing. But what I'm also going to be doing when we get closer to the election is I'm going to be on panels in Fulton County, which is Atlanta, which is the one that's at the center of this investigation, where I'll be on panels that do ballot review and duplication. And those are the paper ballots that for one reason or another cannot be read by the machine when they're fed in. And I will be on a panel I will be representing the Democratic Party, but there'll be a Republican counterpart. That's where there's going to be tension. And you can't let people's personal agendas decide how a vote's going to turn out. And, you know, I'm just a small little fish in this pond, but I can do my part to ensure that election turns out the way the voters wanted it to turn out. Maybe it'll turn out the way I want it to. Maybe it won't, but that's what it has to be. It has to be what the voters want and not what a small group wants.
Right. And I think that's so important what you said, that we may be just one person, but there's a lot of just one people.
Yeah.
That if we all do something, if we all vote, if we all get involved, we can make things different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so trying to understand the other side, I mean, you're going to have to deal with some of that when you're doing that ballot review of it's not personal. We're just looking at the ballots.
I don't know who those people were who cast those ballots. I don't know who they are or what they want. Unfortunately, when I did it during the primary in May, I found out that some of my counterparts on those panels, they weren't very informed. And I foolishly assumed that anybody that would volunteer for something like this would know what they're advocating for, but they weren't informed either. So
what is that? What does it involve? Do you go through a lot of training?
Yeah, you have to be trained. And in Georgia, they changed the law in 2019, and it applies. I mean, excuse me, not 2019. 2021, and it applies for the first time this election, and it makes it more difficult for people to vote. There are a lot of little things in there. You know, you have to fill out the forms and the applications and the ballots exactly correct, or they may not be counted. But yeah, we're trained on what, and they just refer to the law as Senate Bill 202, because that was how it was designated. And we just have to make sure, you know, we look at how they filled in they've shortened the time between the actual election and Georgia has a runoff. You have to get 50% plus one to win an election. Well, now there's not enough time for absentee ballots to be sent in from overseas. Mm-hmm. So in that case, we have ranked choice voting. So we have to understand how that works. We have to understand how much of the little thing you fill in that counts it. It's going to be harder. It is harder. But we do have to train for it. And then we're given assignments and we show up for those hours that we're assigned and vote for other people, which is what I kind of say we do when a ballot is too damaged to be read by a machine. One of the people on the panel will read the ballot to a person who is marking it on the electronic machine and prints it out, and then we feed that ballot into the system. So I make jokes about voting for a lot of people who I don't know. And my dad's widow asked me, she says, does it make you mad if they don't vote the way you want to? Nope. I don't care how they vote, just that they voted. I might think they were misguided. It doesn't make me bad. I just think they don't know what they're doing.
Right. I mean, as long as they vote, that's, mm-hmm. we all have a voice. So as long as they vote. So Rhonda, this is, I mean, fascinating story. You have evolved into an activist after being a non-biased, non-partisan reporter. Mm-hmm. Are there one or two takeaways you'd like to leave for the audience today?
Well, I think I retired when I did. I retired about a month before I turned 63. And the reason I picked that time was my mom, who was outspoken, and she's the reason that I'm a passionate advocate for voting. She passed away the day after she turned 63 from a brain aneurysm. Mm. And so I decided that if I was going to follow in her footsteps, I wanted to have some time to do stuff that was important to me. And I think that you decide how you want to live the rest of your life. And I decided I wanted to continue trying to make things better. I mean, I think I did as a reporter. I really do think I made a difference. And, you know, there are people who are needed for all these things, for advocating for children in foster care in the courts and for voting and for people who can still go to a clinic and the narrow windows that they have where they can get services. And so you just decide you want to help those people, and maybe one person at a time. But retirement can be very time consuming. So right. I say, whatever it is that you care about, just go do it. And do it with all the zest though you can.
Yeah. Thanks, Rhonda. If you want to reach Rhonda, you can email her. She gave me permission to share her email address. So it's Rhonda_Cook@bellsouth.net. And, you know, I appreciate what you said. Like, there are so many ways to get involved. And, you know, as Cynthia Covey Haller told us last week, she's, you know, it's like part of retirement is now contributing and service and giving back. And so I applaud you for all that you are doing, and good luck with the election. And everybody vote. Don't forget to vote.
Yeah. I have a vote necklace on. Vote.
I know, we couldn't see it.
As they said in the 60s, if you don't vote, you don't count.
Right. And it's still true. If you don't vote, and you can't complain if you don't vote. Mm-mm. Right. Mm-mm. So subscribe to Hey Boomer. Get our emails. Find out what's going on. You can subscribe at bit.ly/heyboomer-subscribe. Drop me an email. Tell me if you liked the show. Tell me what you'd like us to talk about. Join us in Costa Rica. Send me an email at wendy@heyboomer.biz. And let me tell you who's coming next week. We're going to stay on this activism theme. Next Monday, my guest is a woman named Amkari Williams, and she's a speaker, a writer, a podcast host, and a coach for activists. And she says there are many areas where we could put our attention that can get overwhelming. So she helps her clients make sense of one or two areas where they feel like they can be effective. And her podcast is called Stepping into Truth. And part of her focus as a coach is working with introverts and highly sensitive people and how they can still be involved as activists. So that should be interesting. And I like to leave you all with the belief that we can all live with passion, live with relevance, and live with courage. And remember that you are never too old to set another goal or dream a new dream. Thank you, Rhonda.
I was happy to be here.
And my name is Wendy Green, and this has been Hey Boomer.